We're going to take just this brief time to do a little review of what we covered last week, and then we'll start with new material. The first thing, if you remember, we discussed was the title of the book of Genesis. And the actual title in the original Hebrew is Bereshit, which means in the beginning. And that's what the Jewish people used to do. They would take the first word of a book and use it as the title for the book. And we can actually see that was done also with some of the New Covenant books like Revelation. The book of Revelation begins the Revelation, and that's what they used to do. Now, the word Genesis takes it, that comes from the Septuagint, a Greek translation of the Bible, of the Old Testament. And Genesis comes from a word that means, for our purposes, divisions. And what it refers to is the 11 divisions in the Bible. They call them 11 toldots. 11 toldots. And as you're reading the book of Genesis, every time you come along the phrase, these are the generations of, that means you're beginning a new section. That's how, in a literary sense, the book was divided up. You're coming to a new section that now looks forward, but not backwards to what happened, although it may build on what happened. We also discussed the authorship, and liberal theologians today, critics of the Bible who discount divine inspiration, make two errors. First, they say the book of Genesis was written much later than it actually was, and they say it was not written by Moses, but it was actually written by a number of authors and compiled into one book. But there's good reason to believe it was written by Moses. For example, Moses records details of the battle with the Amalekites, and details of other things which can only be known by an eyewitness. Similar to, remember when we did the book of John, and we saw that John obviously was the writer, whoever he was, and we just, you know, determined it was John, was an eyewitness to many of the things recorded in the book. So it was not written by a later person, but it was in fact written by the Apostle John. Also, the Pentateuch itself claims that at least portions of the Pentateuch were written by Moses. And so we have, that's called internal evidence. We have internal evidence. And most importantly are the statements of the Messiah. On numerous occasions, Messiah referred to, for example, the law of Moses and other phrases like that that made it clear that Yeshua, Jesus, believed, and of course rightfully so, that the book was written by Moses. And so the position that Moses was the author of the book is a sound position. Now, when it was written is not known, but we do know the latest that could have been written. It could not have been written past the time of Moses' death, obviously. He had to have written it before he died. And he died just before the Jewish people crossed the Jordan to go in and conquer Jericho. Under who? Joshua. You get a little gold star on the top of your page. And so when they crossed is dependent upon when the Exodus happened. Because we know that they crossed 40 years after the Exodus, right? And a good date that most scholars ascribe to for the Exodus is 1440 BC, which means that Genesis would be written somewhere around 1400 BC. Everybody follow that reasoning? Excuse me?
40 years wandering.
Right. The Exodus plus 40 years. And we remember when we're in BC, adding years, you actually subtract, because we're going from a larger number to a smaller number. Now, when we looked at the structure of the book, we found there's two ways we can structure the book. One is the way that we're used to in our culture, and that's by making an outline, a topical outline. So the book of Genesis divides itself very neatly into two sections. Part one is the early history of mankind. That takes us through towards the end of chapter 11. And then part two is the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, which takes us from 12:1 through the end of the book. And so we have, in part one, we would have the creation story, the fall of man, the extension of civilization, and finally the flood. That era ends with the flood. And then part two, we have the patriarchs. So we have Abraham from chapters 12 to 25, Isaac from 25 to 26, Joshua, Jacob from 27. There must be a typo there. I have down there, see what it says, Jacob 27:1 to 26:43? That has to be a typo. I'll correct that and give you the correct. And then Joseph from 37:1 to 50:26, which is the end of the book. The other way it can be structured, remember I talked about those divisions, these are the generations of. These are the generations of comes from the Hebrew word toldot, T-O-L-D-O-T. And so every time you see the word toldot, it's another division. It makes another, in a sense, what we would call a chapter. They didn't have chapters in their writing, but it starts another unit, a new unit in Genesis. And there's actually 12 toldots. 12 times that happens. And each time it happens, it's the start of a new story within the story of Genesis. Okay? We briefly discussed the theology of Genesis, and one of the things we mentioned that's very important was that Genesis was written with the presupposition that God exists. It does not present to us a formal argument for the existence of God. It presupposes the existence of God. Now, the Bible does give us evidence for the existence of God. For example, Psalm 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and other places. The man's conscience, history, creation itself. These are all what we call we would call these natural revelation. We talked about that some time ago. But there's no formal argument. Genesis presupposes that God exists and gives evidence that man, that God has given man ample evidence that he exists. Now, the subject matter in the theology of Genesis is God's work in establishing Israel as a means of blessing the families of the earth. The blessing was lost with the fall. And Genesis, don't forget who Genesis was written to. It was written to the Jewish people who came out of the Exodus. And it was through the Jewish people, and ultimately through the Messiah. Well, it's, first of all, it's through the Jewish people that we got the scriptures. it's through the Jewish people that Messiah came, and so it's through the Jewish people that God ultimately returns humanity to a place of blessing. Okay, that was our introductory material. And so again, that first verse, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, illustrates what I said. Right at the beginning, the existence of God is presupposed. It's asserted. And Psalm 19:1-2 give evidence for the existence of God. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse declaring his works. We also looked at Romans 1:18-20. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And it says, because that which is known about God is evident in them. It's evident that God exists. You don't need the Bible to be a theist. There are many theists, there are many people who believe that God exists who are not believers. Because God gives general revelation. General revelation is the revelation that just exists in this world. The creation itself, the beauty and grandeur of the creation, human consciousness, and a human hunger for God, and history. If you study history, it's clear there's a design and a purpose for history. Special revelation is revelation that is given by God in a special way. For example, when a prophet would have a vision, that would be special revelation. The scriptures are special revelation. And there's many forms of special revelation. But all humanity has not all humanity has special revelation available to it. For example, only two people saw the special revelation that was given on the Mount of Transfiguration, right? We didn't see it. What we have as special revelation today is the scriptures. But all people do have available to themselves general revelation. No matter where you are, the existence of God is apparent in your surroundings and in your inner being. Now, we also discussed that in the Bible there are four beginnings, and the one that we focused on is the phrase in Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And that speaks of the beginning of creation and the origin of all things apart from God, who is eternal. Now we have to remember something that sometimes people get a little mixed up on. Eternity is not a measure of time. There's people that, and understandably so, I used to do this. Ooh, blue. And this is the best we can deal with it with our human finite minds. Here is time. Let's say this is all time. So let's say this is the creation, C for creation. Then let's say this is what we normally call the eternal state, right? When we're in heaven and all human history is finished. What we tend to do is say this is eternity past and this is eternity future. But the words past and future really don't apply to the concept of eternity. Because eternity is not on this line. It's not on the timeline. Eternity as a concept and as a as a thing that has being existed prior to time. And God dwells in eternity. He is eternal. Now, what does included in the concept of eternity is the concept of infinity, because eternity is infinite. But time started right here, and prior to this beginning, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There was no such thing as time prior to that, because time itself was created by God. Everything that exists, whether it's, concrete or abstract, apart from God, has its origin in God as it is created. So that doesn't only include wood, buildings, people, trees, and so forth. It also includes space and time. I'm going to say something that's going to sound like a silly statement, but human language, it's difficult to put these concepts in human language, so I know it's going to be a silly-sounding statement, but I think it will get the point across. There was a time when there was no time. Now, that's a contradictory statement, but I don't know how else to say it. Once there was no time. Eternity is timeless, and only God dwells in eternity. We dwell in time, okay? So when we use the terms eternity past and eternity future, that's really not theologically or philosophically correct, but it's hard for us to put into words certain biblical concepts. When we say eternity past, what we're really saying is prior to creation. And when we say eternity future, what we're really saying is beyond the end of human history as we know it. Yes? A little louder. I can't hear you. Yes. There will be time, and of course, you know it's measured by 1,000 years. Well, that's a good question. This right here. Am I this weak? I have to go take a nap. Anyway, you can't unring a bell. Let's suppose this is the end of human history, which would actually be subsequent to the millennium, right? After the millennium. After the millennium, there's a few things that take place, the final judgment and the final rebellion of Satan right towards the end. But when we get into this realm right here, we are now beyond human history. Now, the question is there time here? The answer is, one of the difficult things that we have is defining what time is. There are those who say that time has an existence of its own, and we move within time. There are other things, people, philosophers, who say time has no existence, it's measured by our movement, or by the movement of objects. So you really get into some kind of crazy deep philosophy if you try and toy around with this. But what we can see is this: there will be, extending beyond human history, a sequence of events, which is the important concept. See, what gives us animation and what gives us what we call time is the fact that there's a sequence of events that life and being are animated, right? That will still continue in the eternal state. So to answer your question, and again, I can only go as far as my finite mind can take me. There will be time beyond the millennium. Now, will time be measured differently? We don't know. Will time be different? We don't know, because it's going to be an eternal state which we have not experienced yet. But there, what we won't be frozen, and we won't be, we know, just spiritual beings continually basking in the glow of God. We'll have bodies and we'll do things. We'll have dwelling places. We'll go in and out of the city. So in many ways, the eternal state is in many ways no different from where we live right now, with the exception, of course, that the curse is gone and God is present. And it's also a very wonderful place when you read its description in the Bible. So it's not that at the end of human race, the clocks come to a halt and there's no such thing as a clock anymore. And one more point. In all likelihood, we know that there's going to be an earth, right? There's going to be a new heavens and a new earth. But how that's going to operate, we don't know, because it's not going to be nighttime anymore. And the thing that makes day and night is the rotation of the earth, right? But since God is present in the eternal state, we won't need that light of the sun anymore, because he will give us continual light. There will be no such thing as darkness anymore. So it's difficult. The scriptures give us just enough information about the eternal state to bring us to the end of our finite minds. Yes?
Mark, you said even history is ordered by God.
Right.
So in this future state, do you think there'll be a history that will be ordered by God?
Yeah, I believe so, because we'll still be, you see, there's certain things about human beings that, you know, we're going to change, right, drastically. But I think there's certain assumptions we can make that, although they're not clearly stated in the scripture, that it's reasonable to believe they're true. For example, we will have memories in the eternal state. We will still have the capacity to recall the future. And so in the eternal state, we will remember the past, we will recognize one another, and on a day-to-day basis, we will, if there are days as we know them now, but as time passes, we will be aware of the sequence of events that we experience. There's no reason to believe otherwise. There's a, not a disease, but there's a malfunction of the brain that some people get. It's the worst kind of amnesia that there is. And it's amnesia where you forget everything as it happens. You don't remember, you have no memory at all. Most amnesia is the past is blocked out, but you know who you are and you know who your wife is. There's an amnesia where as time goes by, you don't remember from 1 second ago. As a matter of fact, I read an article, I can't remember his name. There was a fellow who was an orchestra conductor, and he had this. From moment to moment, he would forget what happened the previous moment, but he could still conduct the symphony orchestra. And of course, doctors were baffled by that, because his memory had to be working in some sense to be able to read the score. But to get back to your question, in the eternal state, the question, will there be time? The answer is, number one, it depends on how you define time. But if the time is defined as a sequence of events, or as that which measures a sequence of events, there will be time in eternity. Okay? Okay, now, yes, and they're aware of the time that's going on earth, too. Sure, why not? Yeah. I don't know that the people who die and go be with the Lord can look down and see the earth and what's going on it, but they know the Bible. They're in the presence of God. They certainly know what's going on down here. It's no mystery to anybody. You used to talk very softly, or I don't hear anymore.
How can they have people who go away after the dark? How do they have memory of like things here and people who are loved ones who chose not to because of God? Do they have this?
That's something that gives people a lot of trouble. Here's the question, and it is something that I don't have a completely adequate answer for. When we are in heaven, I believe that we will remember our earthly lives.
You won't?
Will. We'll remember our earthly lives. And my basis for saying that is the judgment seat of Messiah. Our lives are going to be reviewed as believers for rewards or loss of rewards.
So for sure we'll know it at that point.
Yeah. Well, we'll be in our glorified bodies at that point, so
we'll
still remember. Now, the question that's problematic, and I have the same question as you do, really. How can we be in heaven in a state of happy bliss if our child is not in heaven? Our child never got saved. And I don't really have an adequate answer for that. All I know is that the Bible teaches us that when we're in heaven, there will be no more pain, sorrow, tears, or suffering. So in some way, we will probably have a better understanding of things than we do now. And also, we will probably be very pleasantly surprised at what we find there. I think we have some surprises in store. I think that there are people we won't expect to be there who will be there, and there will be people we expected to be there who won't. Yes? Right, you have to have a memory to have judgment.
Otherwise, how I know if I have no
right,
memory?
You have to have a memory to have a judgment.
Right,
judgment, good point. Okay, so everything that exists originated with God. And remember, that includes everything. For example, governments, presidents and kings, everything. Everything that exists, all of the laws of nature, the seasons, snow. I once saw a show, imagine this, and this was a one-hour show on snowflakes, on how they're formed and why they form into these beautiful little shapes and why everyone is different. And it has to do with the nature of water and how water kind of crystallizes when it freezes. How can you not believe in God when snow? Did you ever catch a snowflake like on a dark, if you were wearing a dark sweater and you catch a snowflake and look at it before it melts? It's a beautiful, beautiful little design. Now, one of the things that's important that we talked about is that the word created, when it says God created the heavens and the earth, translates the Hebrew word bara. And that is creation ex nihilo, creation from nothing. In other words, God's ex nihilo creation of the universe is a bringing forth things apart from himself from nothing. He did not use pre-existing materials. He merely spoke things into being. Now, of course, that's completely beyond our understanding. But when he said, let there be light, there was light. He speaks things into being. And it says in 1 John 1:3, all things came to being from him, and without him nothing came into being that has come into being. Now, in verse 2, we discussed that the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. And we discussed what is sometimes referred to as the gap theory between verse 1 and 2, that between verse 1 and 2, there's a gap. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth, and then there's a long gap, many, many years, And usually what they say is that's when Satan rebelled against God, and what God had created became formless and void. It was in a state of chaos, and God had to remake it. But there's no biblical basis for that. It's a very, very poor biblical interpretive. It's a very poor interpretive process that brings you to that point. More likely, verse 2 just describes a part of God's created work. So verse 2 describes the earth as it was before God completed creation and declared it to be good. In other words, when he created the heavens and the earth in verse 1, and remember we said the heavens and the earth are one word in the Hebrew? They don't, are not one word in the Hebrew. We would say in the beginning God created the universe, wouldn't we? But the Hebrew language doesn't have a word that translates universe. So the way they express the concept of the universe is they say the heavens and the earth, because that's everything. So it's a way of saying God created the universe. And when he first created it, the reason he created it was to be a dwelling place for man and women. And so all verse 2 is doing is describing the state of the earth, which is focused on in the creation story, before God started making it good as a dwelling place for man. It just is going through the creative process. And the key thing here is, at first, God describes the earth as uninhabitable, and then the remainder of the account of creation is merely God making the earth a place that is habitable for human beings. And then we read that the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. And the word moving is actually a Hebrew word that could be translated brooding or hovering. And it's used in the Tanakh to describe, you know how a mother hen protects her chicks? That's what the Spirit was doing to God's creation. He was watching over it and protecting it. Okay, now we're going to begin with new material now, so let me show you where we'll start in the notes. And we start on page 8. We've already gone through number 7, the little formula that's used for each creative day. Now here's where we come to controversy. The word day in the creation story, how long was a day? When it says, and there was evening and there was morning the first day, and there was evening and the morning the second day, and God counts off the days. Now, the question is just how long was each one of those days? And there's 3 major positions on that among believers. One position is that it's called the day-age theory. So where it says A, if you want to, you can put the day-age theory. So if you ever see that in a book, you know what it's talking about. And the day-age theory says that each day, there was a sequence of 7 days, but each day was really a very, very, very long period of time, because of geology and fossil remains and carbon dating and stuff like that. And so the days of creation refer to extended geological ages prior to man's presence on earth. And so those believers who, that's called old earth, that's the old earth theory. And those believers who ascribe to the old earth or day age theory believe that the earth is billions of years old.
The old earth theory and the day age theory are the same thing.
do the same thing, right? Because they say the Earth has been here for many, 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 many years. So that's a day-age theory. Each one of those days was an age. That, more than likely, the majority of evangelical scientists subscribe to that. Now, another theory is that the days are 24-hour periods of time during which God revealed his creative acts. So he revealed his creative acts, and he revealed a different creative act each day to Moses. That's somewhat of a minority position that has no biblical basis. The third view is that the day are 24 literal days of divine activity. And when it says the evening and the morning were the first day, that's 24 hours, just like today. I believe that that is the case. That's called the young earth theory. Young earth. Yeah. Now, there's some very strong argument. And one of the things I should say at this point is the only reason that there's a day-age theory is because science has advanced to a point and gone in a direction that it seems as though to reconcile the Bible with science, you've got to have a day-age theory. But that's eisegeting. That's reading science into the Bible and making the Bible conform to science. And that's not the right way to interpret the Bible. When we talk hermeneutics, remember, you don't do it that way. You exegete. You pull meaning out of the scriptures rather than eisegete, reading meaning into the scriptures. And we have to remember that scientists, even evangelical scientists, are fallen, sinful men who have finite minds. Now, here are some arguments in favor of the young earth theory. First of all, the Hebrew word that's translated day. Do you notice when you read the creation account, every time the word day is mentioned, it's preceded by a number? The first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day, and so forth. Well, whenever the term Yom, Y-O-M, that's the word that's translated day, is attached to an ordinal adjective. An ordinal adjective is simply a number using as an adjective. You know how an adjective tells you something about a noun? So if I say it's a hot day, hot is an adjective, right? If I say it's a beautiful day, beautiful is an adjective. Everybody with me? Remember high school stuff? No, I'm serious. I forget almost everything, so I want to make sure everybody... Okay. So if I say the fifth day, fifth there is an adjective. It's telling you something about the noun day, isn't it? That's called an ordinal adjective, a numerical adjective. Everybody with me so far? Every time the word Yom appears in the Tanakh and it has an ordinal adjective attached to it, it always, without exception, refers to a 24-hour period of time. So there's no reason to believe that Genesis is an exception. Also, a plain reading of the text, let's put it this way. If you read the Bible plainly, without any scientific presuppositions, it plainly reads 24-hour days. You have to fiddle with that concept to make it fit science, and you're not supposed to bend the scriptures to make them fit science. What you want to do is look at your science, compare with scriptures, and if they don't agree, either your interpretation is wrong, or if your interpretation is right, then the science is wrong. Okay? Now, some really strong evidence for the days of creation being 24-hour periods, look on page 9 under E in Exodus 20:8-11. Now, watch what happens. Remember the Sabbath day, that's Y-O-M, Yom, to keep it holy. Now, watch. 6 days you shall labor and do your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. How long are those days? 24 hours, aren't they? The Sabbath is 24 hours long. So here the word Yom is being used as a 24-hour period of time, clearly, right? He's not saying for 6 ages you will do your work, then rest for an age. We don't live that long. Then it goes on to say, you or your son or your daughter, your female servant, your male servant, or your cattle, the sojourner who stays in your house. Now watch with this. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea that is always that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore he blessed the seventh day and made it holy. It's horrible interpretation to say that in that one sentence the word means day in one place and something else in a different place in the same sentence. You see what I'm saying? That's an inconsistent interpretation, very poor. So that's pretty good evidence that the days were 24-hour days. Now, also, think about this for a moment. If one of the things that the day-age people say is that one of the evidences that the earth is very, 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 very old is that we can see stars that are many, many millions of light. Does everybody know what a light year is? Anybody not? Let me show you what a light year is, because this is no eraser, no nothing. Are there paper towels here? Here I have one that's been messed up and is barely acceptable, but I'll take it. Now watch this. Watch, this is an argument. Here's what the day age people say. First of all, light travels 186,000 miles per second. That's pretty fast, isn't it? When you look at the sun, you're seeing the sun as it was 8 minutes ago, because it takes 8 minutes for light from the sun to reach us. When they look in the heavens, they see a star explode. That star may have exploded millions of years ago, and the light is just reaching us. So in a very real sense, the further away you look, the further back in time you're seeing. You follow it? Now, if light travels this far, 186,000 miles in a second, there's what is known when they measure distances in space. The way they measure distances is this. Take this 186,000 per second, multiply it by 60, and you'll get how far light travels in a minute, right? That's going to be a pretty big number. Then multiply that by 60, and you'll get how far light travels in an hour. Right? That's a pretty big distance, isn't it? If it travels 186,000 miles in a second, imagine how far it travels in a minute and an hour. Then you got to multiply by 24 hours. That'll give you how far light travels in a day, right? The number too big to write on this whiteboard. Then if you multiply that times 365, you get how far light travels in a year. You can imagine how far that is if it travels this many miles in a second. When they measure distances in space, they talk in terms of light years. So if they say this star is 5 light years away, and there's no star that close to the Earth except the Sun, but if they would say that star is 5 light years away, what they're saying is it's far away. It's as far as light travels in 5 years, that's how far away it is. Everybody follow that? But the nearest star, aside from our sun, is millions of light years away. Distances we can't conceive of. That's the nearest star. There are stars that are billions of light years away. Billions. Now, what the day age people say is, since the nighttime sky is full of stars that we can see, the Earth has to have been here for billions of years in order for the light from that star, which is billions of light years away, to reach the Earth. Got it? And it seems reasonable. It seems like a reasonable argument. See, we've proven it has to be an old Earth. Otherwise, we wouldn't see any stars. The light wouldn't have reached us yet. Now, here's my response to that. I have a two-part response to that. First is this. In terms of these big numbers we're using, if you measure the time from creation to Abraham, that's not very long, is it? When you're talking about these kinds of numbers. The time from creation to Abraham can just be measured in thousands of years, which isn't even a light, which is, you know, isn't even a light year, right? Then how could God have called Abraham out of his tent and said, look at the sky and count the stars if you are able? The stars were all visible to Abraham. The day age theory doesn't account for that. You follow me?
How does the day age not account for the fact that Abraham...
Because Abraham lived too close to creation. The light from the stars, according to the day age theory, should not have reached the Earth that soon. The other thing that you have to remember is this. When God created Adam, did he create him like a newborn or like a mature man? What about trees in the Garden of Eden and so forth? In all likelihood, God created what we would call a mature universe. So when geologists say, how can you say the Earth is only maybe 6,000 or so years old, when we have mountains that have been formed by the plates of the Earth? You have the Earth as 7 tectonic plates, and they shift and they move. And when one moves against another, it forms a mountain range. And that takes a long time for that to happen. And they say, I have a geologist in my evening class. He says, how do you account for the mountains? Well, God could very well have created a mature universe, which is apparently what he did, because he created Adam mature and Eve. And he may well have created. Also, there are many things about the Earth we live in today that when we try to go back to the point of creation, we run into two very big problems. And here's the problems. We take the Earth as it is today. Based on what we see, we try to go back to the beginning, right? And we see things on the earth today that a long time ago, the way the earth today. But this doesn't account for two very, very important things that took place in this and this time, between creation and our day. The fall, things changed with the fall, didn't they? And more importantly, the flood changed the earth. The flood had a dramatic... Can you imagine the effect the flood must have had on the earth? And so you can't really go from here to here because you don't know what effect these had on the earth. So we don't know what the earth was like before the fall, and we don't know what the earth was like before the flood, so we can't really go back like that. It's just not possible. Of course, there were changes that obviously took place in these two events. Okay? So, it is my belief that when it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and then he goes and there's 6 days of creation, they were six periods of 24 hours each. And if you read the Bible as it should be read, as a literary work that speaks the truth, there's nothing in the creation story that indicates any of the language being figurative. Remember we talked about that in hermeneutics? There's no figures of speech being used. Those numbers are not figures of speech. They're literal numbers that have adjectives that indicate they're literal numbers. I believe that creation is just as the Bible recorded it, and the day, each one was 24 hours. Okay? Okay, now, any questions on that? God's first creative act, creative word, produced light. The elegance and majesty of creation by decree is a refreshing contrast with a bizarre creation story of the pagans. It was God's word that motivated Israel to trust and obey him. Bear in mind, Moses was writing to the Jewish people who had come out of the Exodus. So we have to take this creation story and somehow relate it to the Jewish people wandering in the wilderness and inhabiting the land. So for example, going from chaos to that which is good represents in the mind of the Jewish people going from slavery into the land of promise. There's a connection there. The light was natural light. Its creation was an immediate victory because it dispelled darkness. In the Bible, light and darkness are also symbolic of good and evil. Here began God's work, which will culminate in the ages to follow when there will be no darkness. And notice what it says. Israel would know that God is light and that the truth and the way are with him. In the darkness of Egypt, they had light, and in the deliverance to come, they followed his light. Remember when God brought darkness over the land of Egypt? But not in Goshen, right? God was their light. They had light. And when they wandered in the wilderness, he was their light. Remember the pillar of fire at nighttime? So this creation story does really, it had a meaning to the Jewish people in the wilderness, a very rich meaning that we lose today. It's not our fault. It's just that, you know, we can't appreciate it as much as they did. Which light are you referring to? I wouldn't argue with that. I can't be sure. It was a manifestation of God. Whether it was actually the Shekinah or not, I'm not really sure. That same question is asked of the burning bush. Was that the Shekinah? And it may well have been, but it may have been just a bush that was on fire that didn't burn up. We're not told that it was the glory of God, so we can't assert that it was, but we can speculate that it was. Okay? Okay, let's take our first break. Okay. The second day, bottom of page 9. On the second day, God separated the... Well, somebody do me a favor. Read verses 6 through 8 so we can have it fresh in our mind as we go through this. Verses 6 through 8, the second day. Okay, now just to make sure we know what this is talking about, what God did originally, let's just say, for example, the sun is over here and the earth is over here. Originally, the entire earth was covered by water, right? And then God changed that so that the earth was surrounded completely by a shell of water. You see how it works? And this is called... Now, biblically, there are three heavens. One heaven is what we call our atmosphere. Atmosphere. I can't spell this. Yeah, that's it. Our atmosphere is the first heaven. The second heaven is, let's just call it outer space. That's what you usually call it. But the second heaven is all of the space of the rest of the universe, okay? And the third heaven, and it's called the third heaven in the Bible, that name is given to it, is where God dwells. We can't get to there, obviously. We can't even perceive it with any of our instrumentation or senses. This was the original state of planet Earth. It was based here. This was the atmosphere, and there was this big shell of water around it. Okay? So that's what that's actually saying. Well, on the second day, bottom of page 9, God separated the waters, the atmospheric waters, from the terrestrial waters. Terrestrial means land, by an arching expanse we call the sky. This suggests that previously there had been a dense moisture enshrouding the earth, just as I pictured it up there. Of course, I can only do two-dimensional, it's three-dimensional. You know, God's work involves making divisions and distinctions. Okay. Everybody follow how that works? Now, there are those who say that the reason, remember, you know how people lived a long, long, long time, but after the flood they didn't live as long? There are people who say that shroud of water kept the harmful rays of the sun from hitting people. And so the aging process was slowed down considerably. But when the floodgates of the heavens were open, what they say happened is this big shroud of water just came falling down the earth. The rain that happened during the flood was not like any rainfall we've ever seen. It wasn't like raindrops. Right, as well. Okay, the third day. Dry land with its vegetation was formed on the third day. Now, this is interesting. Vegetation is part of the ordered universe of the true God. There is no cyclical or seasonal myth to explain it. God started once and for all time. In other words, having created, God created the universe in such a way, and most specifically our solar system and our earth and our sun in such a way, so that there would be a cycle of seasons. And there are no gods or Zeus or anybody else causing these things to happen. Once God set that in motion, it remained in motion. However, we've got to remember something, that God, this is not deism. Deism is the belief that God created the universe, wound it up like a clock, and now it's just doing what it's doing and his hands off. He has nothing to do with it anymore. That's not true. God is very involved in his creation. But what we are saying is that the seasons, God did set up the universe and our galaxy and our sun and moon and earth in such a way that there are seasons. Okay?
Is that because 26-degree tilt of the earth meets?
Say again?
26-degree tilt. Earth.
Well, that's what causes there to be seasons. Right. So on the third day, dry land with its vegetation was formed. Go to the fourth day. Somebody read 1:14 through 19. Go ahead. Oh, I forgot to read that. Moreover, while pagans believed in deities of the deep as forces to be reckoned with, this account shows that God controls the boundaries of the seas.
It seems to me that a big deal is made, particularly in the Old Testament, about God controlling the boundaries of the sea, can thunder this, that, and the other, but it can't go. So why are tsunamis allowed to happen?
It's just changed, not broken. The boundary of the ocean, he controls the boundaries of the ocean, and sometimes, for a reason that we don't fully understand, that boundary has changed. There's still a boundary. It still goes so far and no further, and it goes so far as he determines it should go.
I just think that biblical language suggests that it's not able ever to go beyond.
No, it doesn't. The Bible doesn't say that in the biblical language. And we also have to remember something else. God does control the boundaries of the seas, but because we live in a cursed, fallen world, there is what is known in this world as evil. And the word evil can be used to mean two different things in the Bible. It can mean wicked things that people do, and it can also mean any catastrophe, such as a tsunami. That's an evil, or a volcano, or a tornado, or an earthquake. Those are evils. And so a tsunami is one of the things that results from the fall. But God is still sovereign. If there is a tsunami, God still determines, he still has control over exactly where those waters go and how far they go, and no further and no shorter. It's not that he's not in control over it. He is. He's in control of everything. It says in Ephesians 1:11, he works all things after the counsel of his own will.
Aren't the tsunamis caused by earthquakes?
Yes.
So,
I'm sorry, what was the last thing you said?
I said, so if God said there would be earthquakes and diverse...
There's volcanoes under there, too.
So, yeah, so that would change the boundaries.
Yeah, we have to. We as human beings have to realize that the fall... I mean, look at it this way. Because of the fall, look what happens to us. We become old, our skin melts like wax, we hunch over, our teeth fall out, and we drop dead. Well, the earth is the same. It's messed up. It's under a curse. Cursed is the ground because of you. Thorns and thistles it shall yield. And those thorns and thistles aren't limited to the thorns that are on a rose bush and the thistles that are on a cactus plant. Marijuana is a thorn. Those people who say, oh, it's fine to smoke pot. God put it here. It's natural. Well, God put poison toadstools here, too. Eat some of them. We were living in a cursed world. And the curse is on the world because of sin. So if there's a tsunami and thousands of people die, why did that happen? Because of sin. Not necessarily because of any sin that they themselves are committing, just because that's the human condition at this time. We're a fallen race and reaping what a fallen race reaps. Okay. Now somebody read the fourth day, 14 through 19. Okay, now there's two theories on this. Either these two great lights, that's the sun and the moon, right, were created with apparent age. And that's what I was talking about as a mature, the creation of a mature universe. Or they were previously created and were then made visible on Earth on days 1 and 2, when God separated the light from darkness and waters above from waters below. I ascribe to the first theory, that he did create them with an apparent age. These heavenly bodies were to serve for signs and for seasons and days and years. And they do, don't they? You can tell the time by the sun and the moon, can't you? You can look up at the sky and look at the sun. And if I say to you, I want you to call me at 12 o'clock noon, no earlier, no later, and you're not allowed to look at a watch, all you got to do is keep your eye on where the sun is. The sun will tell you when it's noon.
What about daylight saving time?
What about what? We're talking about mark time. I hate it when we go off daylight savings time. That's hard to get used to. These terms, as well as day and night in verse 5, are meaningless without the existence of the sun and the rotation of the planets. You can see how brilliantly God put this together. To have the sun, the earth spin on its axis so we would have day and night and seasons and so forth. And the stars, you know, a good ship's captain can go from one place to another across the ocean and get there just by looking at the sky. And we too, everybody should be able to find the North Star. And once you find the North Star, you know, you have your little compass. Okay, in astrology, unbelievers use stars and planets for guidance, but the Bible says they merely display the handiwork of God. What folly to follow astrological charts of the Babylonians, worship the Egyptian sun gods, or become involved in earth worship, which is pretty big today, rather than trust the one who made these objects in the heavens. However, many humans repeatedly reject the Creator and worship the creation, as it says in the book of Romans. Okay, so now we have the two great lights. Let's move on to day five. Yes?
If we back it up to the paragraph 14, where it says these terms, seasons, days, and years, as well as day and night, are meaningless without the existence of the sun and rotation, that is the basis on which people say that it's possible to have one or more days that was not 24 hours because the sun and moon had not been created.
Yeah, but again, that's not a biblical argument. It's a theological argument.
But it causes problems if you read that sentence.
Why?
Because if you say day and night are meaningless without the existence of the sun, and so somebody says, okay, how are we going to deal with day and night when there wasn't any?
When God said, "Let there be light," here's what you're touching on is an argument that unbelievers often give. How could there be day and night before there was sun and the moon? I'm sure God had a way of doing it.
Sure.
But that passage that I read in Exodus is just too clear. They become meaningless, I should say, as God finally set things up and ordered it. That was ultimately what he did. So they become meaningless would be a better way to say it. Okay, who wants to read chapter 1, verses 20 through 23? Okay, so the great creatures of the sea and the air were created on the fifth day. In this section, in verse 21, is the second use of the word bara, which translates created. Remember that in verse 1? It's only used of God. Great creatures of the deep, worshipped as dragons and monsters in the ancient world, were nothing more than creation by Almighty God. Moreover, fertility of life comes from the blessing of the true God. Okay? God is a giver of life, but he also has the authority and the ability to take life too. The sixth day, somebody read 124 through 31.
Then God said, let us make man in our image,
Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of all the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seed. It shall be food for you, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth, which has life. I have given every green plant for food, and it was so. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day.
Okay, so day six was creation's climax, for it concluded mankind, which is the ultimate apex of creation. Though man was the last creature mentioned in the account, he did not evolve, he was created. We would agree with those who believe in evolution that man came last, but not because he evolved. Human life was created in, and the literal translation is, in the essence of the image of God. And this image was imparted only to humans. It's not said of the animals. Image is not actually defined. Theologians debate what is the image of God in man, and they have all kinds of theories about it. Of course, it's really not defined. We have some clues. It's used figuratively here because God does not have human form. Doesn't it say in the Bible God is spirit? So it's not that we look like him, because he doesn't look like anything. He's a spirit. Being in God's image means, and this is about as far as we can take it, that humans share, though imperfectly and finitely, in God's nature. That is, in his communicable attributes. Remember, there's two kinds of attributes of God, communicable and uncommunicable. Communicable attributes are attributes that of God that he can give to man. For example, life, personality, truth, wisdom, and so forth. The ability to think cognitively, to make decisions. There are certain attributes of God which he cannot communicate or give to man, like omnipotence. That's a non-communicable one. Or omnipresence. So there are those who say that the image of God in man is that man has the communicable attributes of God. God's purpose in creating human life in his image was functional. Man is to rule or have dominion. God's dominion was presented by a representative, man. Egyptian kings later in idolatry did a similar thing. They represented their rule or dominion by making representative statues of themselves, and archaeologists have found these. God pronounced his blessing on the male and female. They were to be fruitful and increase in number. In Genesis, to be blessed is to be rich and prosper. And fertile. And being rich doesn't mean having a lot of money in this context. It means to prosper spiritually, not materially. Such marvelous decrees of God would be significant for Israel, God's representative on earth. She would enter the land of promise and expect God's continual blessing. However, because of sin, not all things are under man's dominion. However, Messiah will establish dominion over all the earth at his second coming. Questions? Okay, we've gone over the 6 days of creation, and now we're going to start chapter two next time and discuss the seventh day, which is very important. You'll notice I wrote quite a bit about it. I filled up a page with it, because the seventh day is very important. So we'll begin next time with chapter two. Questions, comments? Okay.